You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine and director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. On this program, we invite poets to select a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss, along with a poem of their own that's appeared in the magazine. My guest today is Catherine Barnett, who's received such honors as a Whiting Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and for her second book, A Game of Boxes, the James Lachlan Award. Welcome, Catherine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
The poem you've chosen to read for us is Maybe All This by Wisława Szymborska. Can you tell us why this poem stood out to you when you were looking through the archives?
Szymborska is a poet I've loved for her radical uncertainty and radical doubt, sort of with a profound comic intelligence and a philosophical intelligence. So this poem, you'll hear, has all these maybes, which is a form of radical doubt.
Right.
And it is marked by question marks. Mm-hmm. You don't actually need to have a question mark because the maybe is already introducing all the doubt. And I love being a poet because I can inhabit and enlarge questions of doubt and uncertainty and all that we don't know. I can pay attention to what we don't know. I used to be a journalist and was supposed to be an authority. And I love Szymborska because she is an authority of not knowing. She says, I don't know is the most important phrase we should cling to, really.
Well, I'm dying to hear. Let's hear the poem, shall we?
Okay.
Here's Catherine Barnett reading Maybe All This by Wisława Szymborska, translated by Claire Kavanaugh and Stanislaw Baranczak.
Maybe all this. Maybe all this is happening in some lab, under one lamp by day and billions by night. Maybe we're experimental generations, poured from one vial to the next, shaken in test tubes, not scrutinized by eyes alone, each of us separately, plucked up by tweezers in the end. Or maybe it's more like this, no interference. The changes occur on their own, according to plan. The graph's needle slowly etches its predictable zigzags. Maybe thus far we aren't of much interest. The control monitors aren't usually plugged in. Only for wars, preferably large ones, for the odd ascent above our clump of Earth, for major migrations from point A to point B. Maybe just the opposite. They've got a taste for trivia up there. Look, on the big screen, a little girl is sewing a button on her sleeve. The radar shrieks. The staff comes at a run. What a darling little being with its tiny heart beating inside it. How sweet its solemn threading of the needle. Someone cries, enraptured, get the boss. Tell him he's got to see this for himself.
That was Maybe All This by Wisława Szymborska, translated by Claire Kavanaugh and Stanislaw Baranczak, which appeared in the December 14th, 1992 issue of the magazine. So let's talk about this for a minute. What a poem you've picked for us. I do love all the questions. And then there's this, is it a vision at the end? How do you think of this little girl on the big screen there?
Well, I love that moment when there's a turn. Look, on the big screen, a little girl is sewing a button on her sleeve. And it's going from the sort of larger political collective questions to the very particular individual moment. Is the little girl, I mean, someone has said that it comes from a painting of Vermeer, the lace maker. That's that girl in that painting is making lace. This girl is sewing a button. Regardless, the attention to the particular in the face of these huge problems of war or our tininess in the face of the huge universe.
Of all this.
I think the focus on the particular is moving, and also that she uses with its tiny heart beating inside it instead of her. I find that's very defamiliarizing, and the shift from the large to the particular is also defamiliarizing. and the humor at the end. Many of her poems rely on humor to make their powerful indictments.
Right. But it's not a ha-ha humor, is it? It's kind of a... The humor of the everyday, I think, in one way, the vernacular of get the boss, which, of course, is translated so wonderfully. But also, there's a kind of vision that, for me, happens, and also a kind of a vision of mending, you know, and this mending that the darling little being is doing is also a kind of mending that the poem is trying to do. It's trying to sort of mend this clinical place that might be our place.
I think that's beautiful.
Well, I mean, she wrote it, so I think for us to see it in some way.
I think also Szymborska is a poet of astonishment. She has a poem called Astonishment. I think that poem has 17 questions in it. And get the boss, tell him he's got to see this for himself. So just what you're saying, paying attention to the ordinary. And I love what you said. I hadn't thought about that. The act of repair.
Which is, you know, so different. There's the needle of the threading of the needle, and then this needle early on, the graph's needle slowly etches. It's predictable zigzags. They're not just zigzags, which could be somewhat, I don't know, random or interesting. Instead, they're predictable. And I think that idea of the unpredictability of people, of little ones especially, and of beings in general, I think is really interesting at the end.
Well, I read Szymborska earlier on, around 2000, but I was really deeply introduced by Edward Hirsch, who's a poet who's appeared in many of these pages, and he and I appeared together recently, and he's a wonderful poet and has, the first time Szymborska showed up in The New Yorker was a poem he wrote in homage to her called 4 a.m. after Wisława Szymborska. So I really wanted to do a shout out to his championing of her work and then his making use beautifully, as he does, of so many poets as models.
That's a fascinating thing. Do you think that Szymborska shouts back to someone in this poem? Or, I mean, she's such an original that, you know, we're tempted to say not. But I wonder if this poem, you know, echoes for us. And I want to hear sort of how it echoes in your work in a moment. But I was just thinking about that.
That is such a good question. I mean, she's often referencing other artists, but I don't know if there is a specific influence that's coming through here.
Sure. Well, what about the Nobel? How did that sort of change her being received here? Obviously, that's, you know, sad to say for me, that's when I first heard of this fine poet.
Right. So she got the Nobel in 1996, and she called it a disaster because she's a very... not exactly reclusive, but very private person.
Sure.
And she said it, I think it took her a number of years to get back to work. And so that at that moment, I guess the book that brought her here is View with a Grain of Sand, those first 100 poems that these two translators, Claire Kavanaugh and Stanislaw Baranchak, brought to us at that time. And it's was very, very well received. I was interested to bring her up in this podcast because I was teaching her this summer in Italy with this room full of young poets, and they were lit up by the work. They had never heard of her, and they were really lit up. So just to make sure that the younger generation keeps their eye on what she did.
Do you ever translate? Have you worked in that mode?
I did. Sometimes when I'm teaching abroad, I can't write very well, so I do what I call sort of speed translations, poor translations, fast, to just get inside another language.
Wow. And
sometimes I take words in another language I absolutely do not understand and throw them into my own work based on sound.
Right, sure.
And then translate, and that can make an interesting, unexpected mistake.
Well, I mean, I think translation is so important and yet not always done. You know, we should translate more and we don't always read in translation. I think the magazine has done a great job of representing sort of the world of poetry, which is, I think, what our readers and listeners are interested in. But I wonder about that a lot because it's such an important art. And I love what you're saying about how it affects not just, you know, your reading, but your own writing. Yeah. And that's really important.
So this was the first poem that you, the New Yorker, published of hers. These are the main translators, but other poems were translated by other translators. So I had the pleasure of looking at how it appeared here and then comparing it.
But what would you say the difference is?
It's a tonal difference. For example, there's a poem that the New Yorker published in 1996 called Some Like Poetry. And the last of the three stanzas is poetry, but what sort of thing is poetry? More than one shaky answer has been given to this question. But I do not know and do not know and clutch on to it as to a saving banister. So that's the way it was published here. I actually think by Claire Kavanagh, it was like a redemptive, it wasn't the word banister, a redemptive something else. I could look it up.
Sure. No.
But even that, saving and redemptive.
I mean, it's an art, right? Not a science. You know, I think of this a lot with Dante, who is here almost a millennium away. But, you know, not only do the translations tell us about Dante, they tell us about what we need in the moment of translation.
There's a wonderful poem by Carolyn Bergvall called Via, 47 Variations. And she takes the 47 translations. There are more than that.
Sure.
47 translations of the first three lines of Inferno. And she reads them in alphabetical order. And then she just says the translator and the year. And it's a beautiful, you can listen to it online.
Oh,
it's a beautiful, and it makes that point so perfectly.
Right, right. You know? Well, I'm partial to Heaney's opening stanza, but having heard him read it, it just was incredible. One last question about this poem here, maybe all this. There's this word in the second to last stanza, trivia. What do you make of that word? You know, she says, maybe just the opposite. They've got a taste for trivia up there after this war, you know, the serious. What do you think that word conveys? It, mind you, translated, but how do you think that works in this poem?
I think that's an excellent question because that word does what she does so often, which is it slips in irony, you know, and a comic skepticism and a deep tenderness too. Because trivia, she's saying it's not trivia. You know, when the camera comes in close and we see, even just by the act of attention, paying attention to the girl paying attention is already an act of tender humanity. And so I think the word trivia, it's just a tonal success for the contradictions it holds together. You know, it's giving us the word and throwing it away at the same time, I think.
Yeah,
do you think
that's
that?
Great. No, you've put it beautifully. Now, in the June 25th, 2018 issue, The New Yorker published your poem, Sun in August, which you'll read for us in a moment. Is there anything you'd like to say first, anything that might be useful for our listeners and readers to know?
What I became interested as the poem took shape is something I see in Szymborska's work and I see in Ed Hirsch's work also sometimes, which is where the self is made separate from the self, or there's an alienation, or there's a doubling, or there's a kind of radical separation between one self and another self. And I think poets, I don't know, because I am a poet, I don't know about other people, but we go through the world like that a lot, like living fully and with too many nerve endings. And at the same time, surviving it, I think, by stepping out at a slight distance. And Szymborska has been helpful to me to avoid sentimentality by, you know, in that same way,
right,
sort of stepping out.
Well, that's amazing, the stepping out. Well said. This is Catherine Burnett reading Sun in August.
Sun in August. Dignity, I said to myself, as he carried his last things into the dorm. It was not a long goodbye. Nothing sad in it. All I had to do was turn and head up the hill. All I had to do was balance on 2 feet that seemed to belong to a marionette who had no idea what came next or who governed the strings. There's no emergency, I told her. Just get back to your car. That's it. That's all that's required. I didn't mind accompanying her. I myself had nowhere to go. She drove east, then farther east, under a river, through a tunnel, until she found herself back at home, with a purpose. And the purpose was to recognize the green awning, to find a key in a pocket, to fit that key in the lock, take off her shoes, drop them on the floor with others left there like old coins from a place she must have visited. Worth something, but what? There were no clues in the medicine cabinet, none in the cupboard, none in the freezer where she found old licorice and bit of honey, shoved next to a Ziploc of bluish breast milk, all of it frozen solid over 19 years into some work of art, a sculpture, an archaic something of something. She looked at my hands reaching into the freezer, or I looked at hers. They were strong, worn, spackled with age as they removed the milk ice stashed like weed far in the back. Do they even make this stuff anymore? What's it good for? What was it ever good for? Repurposed, she thought. Isn't that the word the kids keep saying these days? Hey, sweetie, she called to the unoccupied room. Hey, love. It was so hot the air from the freezer turned to steam, and she took the ice into her own hands, held it gently against the back of my warm animal neck until something began to melt and I was alone.
That was Sun in August by Catherine Barnett.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.
What a wonderful poem. I love that moment because I don't think people often talk. It's hard to talk about that moment, you know. It's hard to film the feeling of, you know, departure, but also letting go. I mean, that's what I come through to me in having done versions of that. I think it's really moving. But also I love this other self, as you said, the double, the sort of split self. I didn't mind accompanying her. I myself had nowhere to go, which is a great way. I myself has a great tone to it, but also it's, you know, the self talking to the self. You said that came about in the writing, or did it come about in the experience, or which came first?
It came about in the writing because I probably started in the first person, then to avoid sentimentality, threw it into the third person, which is already just an interesting strategy for any poem, and then neither one was satisfying.
Right.
And I think the defamiliarized moment that this is trying to capture was best handled by the gift of the split self that that I think does help us make sense of things that are, you know, when you're kind of overcome, mm-hmm. both by thinking and feeling.
Sure.
You know. Yeah, so it went through many drafts. It went through many journeys.
Well, the son in the poem, who's only really mentioned in the beginning, is another kind of split self, or it almost causes the split. You feel the son is like this absence, but then there's this wonderful image of the breast milk like weed far in the back. And I wondered about that just haunting but also somewhat funny image in your rendering of it. I wondered both about the humor and then also about that sort of image and, you know, how the, I mean, can you get more thinking about this thing that would have sustained the being, to borrow Szymborska's word, years ago, but isn't anymore, you know, and it kind of comes to sustain the she or the I in the poem. How did you think about that image, which I think is just, you know, striking?
I think it, again, it's a question of the power of the particulars and whether the particulars are narratively true or they're emotionally true. You can take your pick on this one. But the power of the thing to carry the emotion. And I believe, just going back to Szymborska, I mean, she's a master of that. And, you know, the pleasure of saying a word like bit of honey or stash like weed or citing the Rilke poem, you know, an archaic something of something, which is, again, a nod to the archaic torso of Apollo, that is just gives a joy and uses the comedy of it, the absurdity of it, to counter sentimentality.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a real mix of recognition in the poem and then of foreignness, I was thinking, and of strangeness, let's call it. And I was thinking about your describing using foreign words that you might not even know the meaning of in your drafts. And there seems to be this kind of love of that foreignness or an embrace of it. And in the poem, the speaker literally puts it on their warm animal neck. That's really, I think, a compelling image as well, this not just simply recognizing this thing, which I think a lesser poem would have stayed with the image, but there's this interaction, there's this reaching out, there's this need to touch, which feels also very true and earned and emotionally true and narratively true, whichever. Take your pick.
Well, that's – thank you. That's very beautiful. And what I am interested in is if you can imagine that situation, then what else could you imagine after that?
Yeah.
So and I think Szymborska is great at that. I think Szymborska weirdly is like an improvisational expert, you know, because in improv you say, if this strange thing is true, then what else might be true?
Right.
So if someone's standing there at the freezer, what else could happen?
Mm-hmm.
And to let the mind move forward, move into the yes of possibility and strangeness. You know, and it's not accident, but there is a quality what you're mentioning, I think, of absurd accident almost, that then how can you make use of it as a poet?
Sure. Yeah. A question about sort of the ending. We had, when I first saw this lovely poem, we talked about the ending and we talked about sort of other possibilities of the ending. And this is sort of a newer ending. Can you tell us what happened there for you?
Yes. It would be an example of many revisions. And this one, it had ended, you know, with the speaker calling into the empty room.
Right.
And to me, the humor of the word repurposed, which would be like Szymborska's trivia, you know, it's a word that is trying to hold two things together.
Sure, sure.
And then I think that what this revision allowed and invited was a further defamiliarizing of those two selves and then a unifying of them in the end, so that I was determined not to end on pathos. I don't think that that person, the speaker who's alone, is pathetic. I think the aloneness is a pulling together of the split self into a whole. Is how I experience. That's how what I think about, that there was a journey to get through the sort of difficulty of it, and the self split in order to survive it, really, and then comes back together in that moment.
Well, it's alone but not lonely.
Yeah.
It's one, you know, it's all one instead of just alone. That's wonderful. I just think the warm animal neck, is there always in the poem, there's a kind of animal quality to it, or instinctive quality, let's call it, where the speaker drove, then went back at home with a purpose. And the repurposed purpose thing is really funny. And the purpose was to recognize the green awning. I mean, this is, you know, she in the poem is just going from thing to thing at first, sort of at a loss.
Yeah.
But I do think the finding in the poem isn't just, of course, of what's in the fridge. It's this finding, as you're saying, of the eye again.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the questions, again, would be the book that this is part of,
yeah.
Human Hours, has four sections that are called Accursed Questions, and they're talking and asking questions of questions. And that brings me back to Szymborska, who, for whom questions was, you know, essential.
Sure. And well, can you bring it back to you for a moment,
yeah.
And tell us a tad more about the book, which is coming out in September, Human Hours. Can you tell us just, you know, what are the sections thematic, or they just range in different modes, or how do you see them?
It's anchored by these four sort of lyric essays or fragmented thinking about questions. And it moves, the speaker of the poems is moving between watching a father lose his cognitive abilities and sort of depart, and then also watching a child in a very happy way depart. So she's navigating that at the same moment that the world is in a kind of upheaval, and she's also very baffled. She's just utterly baffled. And there's a fight between sort of logos and comedy that, you know, you cling to logos. Oh, that'll get me through. Think harder. And then you cling to comedy, and then you cling to logos and comedy. And I think it shifts back and forth with those other concerns about what's happening in the world and what's happening in her own particular world.
Well, I've had a chance to read through the book. It's wonderful. And I know readers will flock to it for some of the very reasons you mentioned and some of the things that I think are present in this poem. I mean, this poem's, where does it fall in the book? Is it beginning, middle, end?
I think it's in the third. So the four parts, it starts with poems, and then there are these four parts. And I think it's in the third part of the you know, standalone poems.
Does he have does Sun return to us, or do we have to wait and see? It says, can you give away the end, or?
You mean in the book?
In the book, yeah.
I think after that, there's a poem where it's not chronological in the narrative
sure.
sense, but where the speaker and the son go to a baseball game, and he loves Josh Beckett, and she loves Samuel Beckett, and they are kind of hashing it out. And there's a moment in that poem that reminds anyway, so I think, I mean, he comes
so
back
he
there.
Loves a ball player. She loves an existentialist
yeah.
who refused the Nobel Prize. And,
yep.
And somewhere they meet.
Yeah, they well, they're just sitting there watching the game. And they, you know, she's got her Beckett. They've got their Beckett.
We all have our Becketts. Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Sun in August by Catherine Barnett, as well as Wisława Szymborska's poem Maybe All This, can be found on NewYorker.com. Wisława Szymborska's most recent book in English is Map, Collected and Last Poems, translated by Claire Cavanaugh and Stanislaw Baranczak, and edited by Claire Cavanaugh. Catherine Barnett's new book is Human Hours, out in September. Thanks again.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.
I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hillary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast, a weekly television podcast that obsesses over all things TV.
Chris, Hillary, and I are at your service to recap and analyze the best that's out there and what you should be watching.
Plus, we're talking to the stars and showrunners about how exactly it all got made.
New episodes of Still Watching drop weekly wherever you listen to podcasts.
from PRX.